60 days to what exactly? Today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Iran is giving Europe 2 months to save a landmark nuclear weapons agreement. The U.S. abandoned the deal a year ago. Now Iran is pulling back too.
Iran feels that, okay, enough is enough. You had your chance and you're not giving us anything out of this.
America's response?
Iran is very practiced in the art of nuclear blackmail, and they usually direct it at European countries.
And later, plant-based burgers that mimic meat are becoming a thing all over the globe. Here in the U.S., some beef producers think it's un-American.
The product is not derived from family farmers and ranchers here in the United States of America, and instead is lab-produced.
Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Iran is partially pulling back on the landmark nuclear deal it signed with world powers in 2015. That announcement today comes a year after the U.S. dropped out of the deal completely, arguing that Iran can't be trusted.
The regime has been fighting all over the Middle East for years.
They are underwriting Hezbollah in Lebanon and in Syria. They're underwriting the Houthis in Yemen.
Lebanese Hezbollah, Palestinian Islamic Jihad.
They're underwriting Shia militias in Iraq. They're underwriting lots of malfeasance inside of Syria. In South America, too. You see the Iranians leaning in with Venezuela.
And so we're taking all the appropriate actions, both from a security perspective and well as our ability to make sure that the president has a wide range of options in the event that something should actually take place.
A year's worth of complaints there about Iran from Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. That last comment was made just this week. Iranian officials have yet to clarify how much of the nuclear deal they'll jettison, but they've demanded that the remaining signatories help them make up economic losses from U.S. sanctions. And Iran has given them 60 days to do so. Dina Esfandre is a fellow at the Century Foundation, where she researches Iran's foreign relations and security in the region.
In 60 days, if the Europeans, the Russians, and the Chinese don't step it up a little bit, Iran will walk away from the nuclear deal, which is exactly what President Trump did a year ago. The difference is that if Iran walks away from the nuclear deal, then it will restart all the aspects of the nuclear program that the deal had constrained. This basically means that Iran will be able to put together the raw materials that it needs in order to make a dash towards a nuclear weapon should it decide to do so at a later stage. Now, today, it doesn't have the capacity to put these raw materials inside a bomb in order for Iran to have a nuclear weapon. But certainly, if it manages to get together the raw materials to do it, that would severely shorten the time that it would take for Iran to do that.
How worried are you that tensions between the U.S. and Iran will escalate? I mean, do you think Americans are any less safe today than they were yesterday?
I don't think Americans are any less safe because despite the elevation of Iran to such an important threat to the U.S., I don't think Iran poses a threat to America and to Americans in the U.S. It may do so in the region, but even that, I would argue that the Iranians don't want any kind of conflict with Americans. They know that they're not necessarily in a position to do well in a conflict with the U.S., and so they'd rather avoid it. The problem is that the current U.S. administration's maximum pressure campaign seems to be setting the scene for the increased risk of either miscalculation or a mistake and eventually a path to confrontation.
Dina Esfandre is a fellow at the Century Foundation. The Trump administration, as we mentioned, sees Iran as a serious threat on multiple fronts. Brian Hook is the State Department's top official on Iran. Here's how he reacted to the news that Iran is pulling back on the deal.
Iran is very practiced in the art of nuclear blackmail, and they usually direct it at European countries. The thing that we're going to be watching very closely is whether any of these decisions might reduce their breakout. How quickly could they constitute a nuclear weapon? And so we're going to be looking very closely to make sure that that breakout timeline does not shrink.
I want to come back to the U.S. position, though. I mean, it was the U.S. who withdrew from the nuclear deal. Why should it expect Iran to continue complying with it? Isn't that trying to have your cake and eat it, too?
No, because it's not a legally binding agreement. I was in a meeting with Foreign Minister Zarif at the UN, and he made it very clear that it's not an agreement. It's just a plan of action, to which we say if it's just a plan, plans can be changed. We spent the first year of our administration seeing if we could fix it. I spent a lot of time with my European counterparts trying to address some of the big deficiencies. This deal starts expiring in 18 months, the first provisions, and then it's gone in 2025. So whether we get out now or wait till 2025, the Iran nuclear challenge has not been addressed.
President Trump has been sitting down with Kim Jong-un of North Korea, one of the more reckless leaders in the world. The language and posturing of the U.S. never seems to demonize Kim Jong-un. Why does the U.S. offer an olive branch to Pyongyang and yet saber rattle toward Tehran? What's that about?
I think you missed the first year and a half of statements by this administration about North Korea. It wasn't that long ago in his UN General Assembly speech where he laid in pretty strongly to Kim Jong-un.
Didn't miss them, but even since the rapprochement, North Korea hasn't behaved that well. I mean, so why continue a relationship?
I think I would disagree with that. When you look at all the different ways that that North Korea has suspended a lot of the activities that it was undertaking during the Obama administration and for the first part of this of the Trump administration, they were coloring outside the lines on a pretty regular basis.
But they just tested a missile over the weekend.
Yeah, that was just over this last weekend. But I'm taking a view over the last couple of years. We have de-escalated the situation on the Korean Peninsula. Shifting over to Iran, with the defeat of ISIS, if you look in the Middle East, the most significant threat to peace and stability in the Middle East is Iran's foreign policy. And Iran has made it very clear they don't want to talk to us. That's fine. We've made it clear that we're open to diplomacy. We've got to see a change in behavior.
When all is said and done, isn't the U.S. essentially calling for regime change in Iran? Washington isn't using that language, but isn't that the intent?
No, it's not the intent. The future of Iran is up to the Iranian people. It's not up to the United States. We know that the Iranian people want a more representative government, and we support that. So we'll continue to stand with the Iranian people for their desire for a more representative government. We want the regime to change its behavior so we have a more peaceful and stable Middle East. But the future of the government's up to the Iranian people. It's not up to the United States.
Brian Hook is a senior policy advisor to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. And Rana Rahimpour covers Iran for the BBC Persian Service. We just heard from Brian Hook, who is Trump's man on Iran, that the Trump administration is with the Iranian people, that their stance toward Iran and their pressure on European allies is really in the interest of Iranian citizens for a better Iran. How would an Iranian respond to that?
There are very few Iranians who would be fooled by this, to be honest, because they know that through sanctions, the regime won't go. The only people who are getting poor are the ordinary people. The elite have hidden their money away and have been pocketing money. And in fact, they're going to earn more from these sanctions because they are the ones who have to find ways to go around the sanctions. So there isn't a moment that any ordinary Iranian feels that the United States has the people of Iran in its mind. Especially Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has a list of 12 conditions that said if Iran abides by these, we can negotiate. When you look at those conditions, none of them is about human rights. None of them is talking about how the Iranian population has been suppressed and cracked down by its regime. It's all about American interests. So I don't think that any Iranian would think that America has the interest of people in its mind. It's all about America.
What are you hearing more informally from Iranians about the stance their government has taken?
Some say that it's actually too little and too late. Some think that, yes, it's fair enough. And some say that it's not a good idea and Iran is not in a position to further escalate the confrontation with the United States. We get mixed messages.
Have you been seeing much on social media from Iranians on this one-year anniversary of the U.S. withdrawal from the nuclear deal?
Yes, and the majority of people are worried about what will happen next. Events of the last couple of weeks, the United States adding Iran's Revolutionary Guards to the list of terrorist groups, as well as putting sanctions on Iran oil industry, they feel very squeezed. The United States has also sent an aircraft carrier to the Middle East. So everybody, the big question among the Iranians is that, is there going to be a war? And it's a genuine concern among the majority of the population at the moment.
Wow. They're genuinely concerned about that, a real escalation with the U.S.
They are genuinely concerned about that. Every time I speak with anybody in Iran, the first question is that, is there going to be a war? Because they see that they can't see any side of this confrontation, i.e. Iran and the United States, to back off. it seems that just the tension is rising, despite the fact that the Americans say they don't want war and Iran says that they're going to stay in the deal at least for another 60 days. People are worried that after these 60 days, what's going to happen? They're just going towards a corner that they can't see any way out of.
Ron, are you seeing any indication that Iranians think that Europe will kind of buck the United States and go its own way with Iran?
I personally think that they want to show that they've done everything they could possibly can. They want to show that they did stay in the deal. They did play by the rules of the international community. And still, it was betrayed by the signatories of the JCPOA or the nuclear deal. I think they're realistic enough to know that there's not much Europe can do. Many of the companies that are refusing to work with Iran are private companies, and they have dealings with the United States, and they cannot risk huge dealings that they have with the United States just to keep Iran happy. So it's a very difficult position for Iran to be, but I think they just want to show that they have played by the rules.
Rana Rahimpour covers Iran for the BBC Persian service. She joined us from London. Thanks a lot, Rana.
Thank you.
A few people in Iran have stressed out for a totally different reason than diplomatic tensions. They're zookeepers at Tehran Zoo. Last week, a 6-year-old Persian lion was sedated in Bristol, England, and flown to Tehran. Kamran the lion is waiting there for a female Persian lion who's coming from an Irish zoo. The hope is that they'll mate and provide a growing family of lions for generations of Iranian visitors at the zoo to enjoy, because the subspecies of Persian lion disappeared from Iran 70 years ago. Alexander Sliwa is a specialist on wild cats. He's with the European Association of Zoos and Aquaria. He's in Cologne, Germany. Alex, the Persian lion hasn't been in Persia for about 70 years. Why did it disappear from Iran?
Wherever lions are disappearing, it's due to conflict with people. So they've been hunted out, poisoned out, went extinct due to human causes.
So the blind date in Tehran is set up for Kamran, the Persian lion that's coming from England, and a female Persian lion from Ireland. How did this come about?
We were approached by the veterinarian of Tehran Zoo actually quite a few years ago, since the lion is a national emblem. And there was a great desire to bring back a real Asiatic lion to the country.
Is the goal of this plan to bring these lions back to be in a zoo in Tehran, or is it to reintroduce them to the wild of Iran?
It is clearly from our side to send this lion back to the zoo of Tehran. It's not meant to go back to the wild. Iran is a densely settled country with most of the large areas populated. And bringing back such a conflict species would require a very, very lengthy process of massive preparations.
How successful has it been in the past when you have kind of the blind date in terms of mating? Does it typically work out when a male lion meets a female lion?
You know, there's never a guarantee. Depends a lot also on individual characteristics. You know, there's some animals which are essentially, you know, to put it in human terms, fall in love, and some other ones who don't get along. Normally, breeding lions is not so difficult once they like each other. But these two lions have never met before, so we don't know.
Is there any political overlay to this? I mean, is it a kind of big cat diplomacy between Iran and Western Europe?
Actually, personally trying to stay out of this very clearly, because there have been a lot of conflict over the nuclear program, sanctions back and forth, which have definitely slowed down the process of transfer.
Alexander Sliwa is with the European Association of Zoos and Aquaria. Thanks a lot, Alex.
Pleasure.
Just ahead, a juicy hamburger. Hold the meat. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. The Whopper from Burger King is an icon of American culture. But there's a new Whopper these days that's gotten a complete overhaul. And this version of the classic burger has a big mission: to help save the planet. Here's The World's Jason Margolis.
People in the St. Louis area have recently been seeing this commercial.
This Whopper has no beef.
That's impossible. This tastes just like a classic Whopper.
No beef.
Introducing the Impossible Whopper with a patty made from plants.
I'm sorry?
The new Impossible Whopper comes from Impossible Foods, a Silicon Valley startup. Scientists there spent years trying to find just the right plant-based formula to recreate the flavor, texture, and sizzle of a beef hamburger. It's part of a global effort to cut down on the environmental impact of meat, especially beef. The Impossible Burger has already been available in select restaurants and grocery stores for a while, but the company is hoping its appearance in 59 Burger Kings around St. Louis will be a breakout moment.
Tastes just like a Whopper.
I've never had plant taste like beef before.
Tastes like a Whopper.
That's Burger King's spin. Of course, I wanted to put it to the test myself.
Hi. Can I get one regular Whopper and one Impossible Whopper, please?
I went to a St. Louis Burger King to try it out. I sat in a corner booth and put the two burgers side by side.
I haven't been to a Burger King in a long time. I used to come a lot as a kid in high school. I know what the Whopper tastes like. The taste has not changed.
I removed the onions because I don't like onions, then bit into my alternative Whopper and articulated my thoughts, mouth stuffed with food.
I gotta say, I don't think it's quite as flavorful. It's close, but it's not exact.
Now, not to be too disparaging towards Burger King, but neither Whopper was worth writing home about. That said, I've had an Impossible Burger at another restaurant, and it was terrific. Juicy, moist, super flavorful meat crumbles. It's also similar to beef in terms of calories, protein, and fiber. So, how did they do it? Impossible Foods says the key ingredient is a protein from soy called heme.
We were the first to discover that heme is what makes meat taste like meat. It's highly abundant in animal muscle tissue, and if you were to eat meat raw, that bloody flavor that you get, that's heme. And when you cook meat, with all the different flavors and aromas that you get, that is catalyzed by heme as well.
To scale up, scientists at Impossible Foods genetically engineer yeast to produce big batches of heme and combine it with other plant-based ingredients. The company's five-word mission statement is bold: to save meat and Earth. They say modern animal agriculture is wreaking havoc on the climate and our ecosystems, and they want to entice burger lovers to a satisfying substitute.
They're actually going after meat eaters, trying to create a product that actually does imitate meat in a way that you wouldn't really know the difference.
Eric Bull has also tried the Impossible Burger.
They're not trying to go for the niche market of vegetarians and vegans. They're really looking at the broader public and doing a pretty good job of creating products that taste fairly similar.
Bull isn't some vegan environmentalist. He's with the Missouri Farm Bureau, which represents the state's livestock producers. The writing is on the wall. The vegetarian burger movement is growing fast. White Castle is selling an Impossible slider, and Carl's Jr. sells a burger produced by the company Beyond Meat. And now Burger King says its St. Louis experiment has gone so well that it's rolling out the Impossible Whoppers nationwide. Add it up, some ranchers are bracing for a fight against meatless burgers.
I have not tried one, and I do not intend to.
Bill Bullard is the CEO of RCAF USA. He represents about 5,000 cattle producers. He says consumers are being misled about what they're actually eating.
And so these companies need to be disciplined or have the responsibility and integrity to clearly denote that the products that they are producing and offering to consumers is not a meat product, is not derived from family farmers and ranchers here in the United States of America, and instead is lab produced.
Several states are considering laws requiring that only products from animal flesh can use the word meat. Missouri passed the first such law last summer. Backers of the new plant-based products are pushing back with a lawsuit, arguing that the labeling laws muzzle free speech and are an attempt by the conventional meat industry to stifle competition. And in fact, the Impossible Burger doesn't use the word meat in its labeling, so they're in compliance with the new Missouri law. Eric Bull with the Missouri Farm Bureau supports his state's new law, but says his industry can't fight new meat alternatives with just labels.
I don't think that these products are going away anytime soon, and the money that is behind them is significant. If we are just going to pretend like it doesn't exist, we're doing our own industry a disservice.
Bull says farmers need to compete by better selling their own story. Humans are omnivores who have always eaten meat. And beef remains just as healthy as the new plant-based alternatives. But nutrition isn't Impossible Foods' hook. Again, they're all about allowing you to keep enjoying your burgers while also lowering your impact on the planet.
The World's Jason Margolis there. So as Jason mentioned, the idea behind the meatless burgers is to create a more environmentally friendly alternative to beef. According to the World Resources Institute, raising cattle is by far one of the most carbon-intensive ways to produce protein. One big problem? As they digest their food, cattle produce a lot of methane, a powerful greenhouse gas. Paul West has studied that impact. He's with the University of Minnesota's Institute on the Environment.
At a global scale, what we eat, it matters a lot because agriculture as a whole, it accounts for about a quarter of all the emissions on the planet. So that's more than all the planes and trains and automobiles, electricity in our houses, etc. And one of the biggest impacts on our climate in terms of food is livestock, especially beef. Now, I know it sounds funny if you think about a cow that is burping and farting, and yet it does actually have a big impact on the planet.
Is it all the burping and farting that creates the methane gas?
Yes, and having a focus on methane from our livestock certainly has a very big impact in terms of overall impacts on the climate, but it's also we're able to see a positive impact on the climate in a short amount of time.
One thing I want to clear up is we're focusing on meat, livestock. Is that because they produce more methane than dairy cattle?
In general, dairy products have a smaller amount of impact because you are getting a product like milk every single day. So the amount of emissions per amount of food is a lot lower than if you raise a cow that lives for 2 years until you
slaughter the cow.
Yes.
The big news, of course, is that Burger King announced it's going to start offering this plant-based burger at all of its locations by the end of the year. Do you take that as a sign that the plant-based movement is going mainstream?
Yes, I certainly do. And that's because it's moving out of a niche market, which is extremely exciting. If it is a common item at the fast food chains or at diners, I think it helps with a reduction in the amount of beef that is eaten. However, at the same time, maybe a similar amount of impact is that it raises our overall awareness and conversation about impacts of beef on the environment.
Paul West is the lead scientist of the Global Landscapes Initiative at the University of Minnesota. Thanks a lot, Paul.
Thank you.
You're with the world. I'm Carol Hills. Climate change is wreaking havoc around the Arctic, but for U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, there's an upside.
Steady reductions in sea ice are opening new passageways and new opportunities for trade.
That story, plus how Remain in Mexico is working for migrants and communities on both sides of the border, just ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. It's been called an epidemic, and it's been going on for generations. Indigenous women have been disappearing in both the U.S. and Canada. Until recently, there's been little public attention paid to their stories, but the families of these missing and murdered women are demanding to be heard and counted. The World's Allison Herrera has our story.
Okay, so this is 240th Street. Eventually, we're going to go down that hill.
Tina Russell drives along a main road in Kent, Washington, about a half an hour south of Seattle. She's taking me to the place where her niece, Alyssa McLemore, used to live.
So this is where we used to live, this house on the corner.
This one with the Christmas lights?
Mm-hmm, this peach house.
Tina says we're not far from the last place her niece was seen before she went missing. She points out the spot where someone said they saw Alyssa talking to a man in a green truck with out-of-state plates.
Back there, that was Highway 167, which takes you to pretty much Seattle one way, Bellevue.
It's been 10 years since Alyssa disappeared, but Tina hasn't given up trying to find her. She keeps flyers with Alyssa's picture tucked in the backseat pocket of her SUV so she can hand them out. She never stops hoping someone might have seen her.
Somebody knows something. Somebody knows something. And we just need them to come forward. It can be email. It can be, you know, anonymously, whatever. Just come forward. It's 10 years. Our family is still suffering.
Alyssa McElmore is Aleut and one of thousands of Native American women who've gone missing or been murdered over the past few decades. It's difficult to know the exact number, but the rate of violence against Native women is disproportionately high. A few days before Alyssa disappeared, her grandmother, Barbara McElmore, called her to come home. Alyssa's mother, Gracie, was dying. Alyssa said she was on her way.
In all the years her mom was sick, she might go away for like a few hours or something, but she was always there. She wouldn't just go somewhere and not show up. She might be late, but she'd be there.
But she didn't come home. It was a chaotic time, and the family isn't clear on when a missing persons report was filed. Tina says she contacted the police, but Alyssa was 21 at the time, and the police said they couldn't do anything for 24 hours. The police say when a 911 call came in from Alyssa's phone pleading for help, they opened an investigation. So far, Tina says, it's yielded few clues and little action. Tina says now, anytime she hears about a death on the news, she gets a sick feeling.
Every single time there's a body found on the news, there's a pause. You, it's literally like you're dead for a moment because you have to wonder, is it Alyssa? I think I've called the coroner more than anybody should in a lifetime.
Over the border in British Columbia, Lorelei Williams tells a similar story.
They never have enough red dresses. So
Lorelei is driving to a performance of her dance group, Butterflies in Spirit. They wear red dresses when they perform, a symbol for missing and murdered Indigenous women. Lorelei's family in Vancouver is still looking for her aunt, Belinda Williams, who is from the Tsuut'ina Nation. She went missing 41 years ago, 2 years before Lorelei was born. Lorelei says authorities didn't open a missing persons file until 2004. She's not sure why it took so long, but a Vancouver newspaper reported that it followed the arrest of the notorious serial killer Robert Picton. He was convicted of killing 6 women and is believed to have murdered dozens more, including Lorelei's cousin, Tanya Hollick, also from Tsuut'ina Nation, who disappeared in 1996. Her DNA was found at his farm. Lorelei says Vancouver police didn't take Tanya's disappearance seriously. One officer was especially dismissive.
She said horrible things. She said stuff like, she's just a drug addict. Nobody cares about her. And she actually told my aunt to go try find her, go try figure things out, and then come back and report her again.
Which meant police weren't looking for her in the critical first days she went missing.
It's all these systems that are against us, Indigenous women and girls, and that's why predators know that they can target us.
Provincial authorities later acknowledged failures in the Picton investigation, and they launched an inquiry to determine what went wrong. And in 2016, Canada opened the National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls, interviewing more than 2,000 families. The final report is due in June, but Lorelei Williams and others are skeptical that much will come of it.
It's so heartbreaking that, you know, this is our country, these are our lands, and our women are going missing and being murdered at a high rate on our own lands, on our own territories, like across the board in Canada, in the States.
It's not just a lack of attention. Another issue on both sides of the border is a lack of data.
We can't solve problems we don't check. We can't prevent violence that we don't bother to pay attention to.
Anita Lucchese says it seemed like no one was keeping track of these missing and murdered women. So she figured she would.
I couldn't afford Wi-Fi, so I was working at a coffee shop, and I was sitting at a Panera, and I really thought someone else already had created this list. So we assume, oh, surely someone's doing something about it.
I spoke with Anita in Berkeley, California, at the launch of the Sovereign Bodies Institute, which gathers data on gender and sexual violence against Indigenous people. She's the executive director there. She says the more she looked at what records were available, the more she realized how incomplete they were, especially when it came to race.
many law enforcement agencies still don't track race at all or don't include a signifier for Native American within the options. They'll just do like white, black, Hispanic, Asian. And then many of the cases that do get logged into systems are misclassified because the officer looked at someone and assumed or didn't enter the information in the system defaults to white.
Anita says she's filed numerous records requests with law enforcement agencies across the United States. And she's tracking missing women in Canada, too. Her database now includes more than 5,000 names of women, going back to the early 20th century, though most are from the past 20 years. She says that number is an undercount. Anita says the database is a keeper of names, but it's also data about Native women and girls collected by Native women and girls, and that in itself is powerful. She calls it data sovereignty. She says she grew tired of hearing people say they didn't know how to fix these problems.
And so it becomes this excuse for people to just kind of throw their hands in the air and just say, I don't know. But that's not good enough anymore. So that's the work of the database. That's the work of Sovereign Bodies Institute, is to say we're not going to throw our hands in the air anymore.
In the past few years, several states have passed legislation to raise awareness about missing and murdered Indigenous women. And Savannah's Act, named for Savannah LaFontaine Gray Wind, who was killed in North Dakota in 2017, has been reintroduced in Congress to set guidelines for law enforcement agencies investigating missing Indigenous women. In Canada, Lorelei Williams plans to travel to Ottawa next month to hear the conclusions of the national inquiry. But she's not sure how much comfort it will bring her family.
My family has been broken apart. It's never been the same.
As for Tina Russell, who still carries flyers with photos of her niece Alyssa, she says her family is frozen in time.
We don't know what happened, so we can't heal. We can't begin to heal. We can't begin to really... Life goes on, but like I said, we're just putting a Band-Aid over something that is really a stitches job. You know, until we find Alyssa and bring her home, it's going to cause generational trauma.
For the world, I'm Allison Herrera.
Allison's story was supported by a grant from the Solutions Journalism Network and was produced in collaboration with Al Jazeera's Fault Lines. Watch Allison's Fault Lines documentary at theworld.org. The Arctic is warming up faster than any other part of the planet. That means big trouble for a region that's been defined by cold and ice for as long as people have been around. But for U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, climate change in the Arctic is a non-issue and maybe even a good thing.
Steady reductions in sea ice are opening new passageways and new opportunities for trade.
That's Secretary Pompeo speaking at a meeting of Arctic countries this week in Finland. Pompeo didn't use the words climate change or global warming in his speech. Mostly, he said the changes in the region present an economic bonanza.
The Arctic is at the forefront of opportunity and abundance. It houses 13% of the world's undiscovered oil, 30% of its undiscovered gas, and an abundance of uranium, rare earth minerals, gold, diamonds, and millions of square miles of untapped resources.
Reporter Amy Martin has a different take. Last fall, she reported a documentary series on Arctic climate change for us here at The World. She says Pompeo's remarks stand out from other world leaders at the summit.
It was very interesting on a lot of levels. I think the fact that he's talking about how sea ice loss and other effects of global warming could open up new commercial opportunities in the Arctic, that in a way isn't exactly big news. That's actually something that everyone with a stake in the Arctic is recognizing at this point. But what makes it interesting coming from him as a member of the Trump administration is that, of course, they're refusing to talk about climate change, not just in this speech, but in all sorts of ways, including in the joint declaration that the Arctic Council usually releases. Prior to Secretary Pompeo's speech, the U.S. delegation had just spent quite a bit of time and energy trying to change the declaration to eliminate the words climate change and global warming or referencing the Paris Agreement. And in fact, this was the first time ever that the Arctic Council released a declaration without all of the Arctic countries signing on to it because of this refusal to talk about climate change.
like you said, I mean, Pompeo isn't the only one who's seeing a bonanza in the Arctic region. I mean, you mentioned a few of them yourself in the stories you did for us last fall. Here's a Finnish shipping executive you spoke with about all the new economic opportunity up in the Arctic.
There will be increase in the transit traffic, increase in tourism, and of course, the great investment potential, which is worth $1 trillion.
Amy, what's he referring to?
Well, he's referring to the same thing that Secretary Pompeo is referring to, which is that, you know, as sea ice recedes, it's making it easier to get to the fossil fuels that are all around the Arctic. And it's not only that, it's also, you know, moving those commodities around. The shipping lanes are opening up all across the north. And then there's lots of onshore resources that might become more easy to get out into the market. Ironically, because we are warming the planet, we might be able to get to more of the resources that will cause more warming.
Talking about Pompeo's remarks, it also seems notable how much he focused on the potential conflict in the Arctic region. I mean, he made it clear that the U.S. isn't happy with what other countries are doing there, including Russia, which is peculiar because Russia actually controls a lot more of the Arctic than the U.S. does.
Yeah, and one of the people I spoke with, Victoria Herman, who's the president of the Arctic Institute, she really expressed a lot of dismay about this aggressive tone in the secretary's comments. One of the things that's really interesting about the Arctic Council is that it has been a forum for these eight different countries to work together on environmental issues and sustainable development issues. And I think there was quite a bit of shock and even dismay about the way that this kind of speech can undermine all of that bridge building that's been going on for decades. So here's what she told me.
It is the first time since the Arctic Council was established in 1996 that the participants were unable to reach a cooperative agreement. And it sets a really dangerous precedent.
So what might be the impact of that on the ground in the Arctic region?
Well, I think it's important to remember that there are 4 million people who live in the Arctic. Many of them are from indigenous communities. Many of them are living with very strong ties to the natural environment there. A lot of people are getting the majority of their food from the sea, from the land in the Arctic. And so it really matters what is happening at this very high governmental level, because if all of the 8 Arctic countries are working together, there's a possibility of establishing ways of basically managing the changes in the Arctic together in a way that's good, hopefully, for the people and all the other life that's in the Arctic. If there starts to be a lot of tension between all the different Arctic nations and we get kind of wrapped up in our own, struggles for power, the people who are really going to lose in that are the people who live in the Arctic, who really depend on that region for their livelihood and for their cultural survival.
Amy Martin, host and executive producer of the Threshold podcast, whose current season is all about the Arctic. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
We have an update now on the Remain in Mexico program. That's the U.S. policy that forces asylum seekers to wait in Mexico as their cases play out in U.S. courts. There's a lawsuit to halt the policy. But this week, a federal appeals court said the Trump administration can continue the program, at least for now. The World's Monica Campbell recently saw up close how Remain in Mexico works in Ciudad Juarez, Mexico, just across the U.S. border from El Paso.
Last month, Blanca reached the U.S. border. She had 3 children with her niece's kids. She raised them in Guatemala for years, she says, while her niece worked in the States. Now, the plan was to meet her niece in California and reunite the family. Blanca says life was becoming more violent. Gangs robbed her home. It was time to go. But when Blanca and the kids reached Texas and asked for asylum, she was surprised at what happened next. She says the kids were taken to another area. She's not sure where. Blanca was sent back to Mexico. She hasn't seen the kids since, but hears from their mom that they're in a government-run shelter. Blanca is on a different track now, part of a new U.S. policy for some asylum seekers. It works like this. Blanca was returned to Mexico, to Ciudad Juarez, just across from El Paso. Then, when it's time to see a judge in El Paso, she's escorted by U.S. officials to the courthouse, then escorted back to Mexico once it's done, back and forth until her asylum case is decided, which could take months or longer. I met Blanca at a church shelter in Juarez. It's overflowing with families sleeping in the pews, but it's safe inside, and lots of kids are running around. And every once in a while, because this is it's quite crowded here, there's going to be a sound like this that goes by. And that's the kids who are going up and down here, kind of made their own racetrack with several toys. Blanca reaches into a plastic bag and shows me the paperwork with her U.S. court date. You should arrive at the port of entry listed above at 6 a.m. on May 9th. May 9th, this Thursday. It's just one of several hearings. Her big worry is where she'll stay in Mexico throughout it all.
Bye, entonces. Tenemos que... Aquí ya no nos reciben. Y viene más gente.
Blanca can't stay at the shelter much longer. There's a limit as new people arrive. The U.S. government says keeping people like Blanca in Mexico is necessary as the number of migrants approaching the border spikes. Here's Kevin McAleenan at a Senate hearing in March. At the time, he led Customs and Border Protection. Today, he's acting Homeland Security Secretary.
What it's going to allow us to do is actually increase access to court proceedings and to increase access at ports of entry to process more people, because we don't have to hold them in the limited space available at the port or in ICE facilities.
Human rights advocates blast the policy and say limited detention space isn't a reason to keep people in Mexico. They say allow asylum seekers into the U.S., perhaps with ankle monitors, while they build their case. At the Senate hearing, McAleenan also said the new policy will weed out sham asylum claims.
It's going to be a much more expeditious process to get an immigration court result and ideally grant asylum to those who have meritorious claims and then create a process that has integrity for those that don't.
Republican Senator Mike Lee of Utah agreed.
So the Remain in Mexico program helps us help actual asylees, helps us discourage human trafficking.
But the policy keeps people far from lawyers and a chance to make their case for asylum, says Taylor Levy. She's an immigration attorney in El Paso. She also says Remain in Mexico puts migrants in danger. She tells me what happened recently when she helped two families coming in from Mexico to their court hearing in El Paso.
It was two fathers and their wives. Both wives were pregnant, and the two fathers had been kidnapped the day before their court hearing, beaten, tied up, interrogated, threatened for many, many hours before they were eventually able to escape. One of them had a broken finger. He had a bloody head wound. The other father I saw on his own wrists where he had like the ligature marks from being tied up and the bruises on his back.
The fathers told Levy they were robbed at gunpoint as they left a shelter. Criminal groups have a heavy presence in this part of Mexico, and migrants are easy targets. At the shelter in Juarez, the kids are still playing. Blanca says she never leaves the place, not ever. It's in a rough part of the city where shootouts are common. She also fears kidnappers who could extort her relatives in the U.S. That's why she asks not to use her full name. None of this is new in Juarez. The U.S. State Department's own website warns of violence and gang activity here. U.S. government employees in Juarez are limited where they can go. I asked government officials why asylum seekers should wait for months here, the same city considered dangerous for the U.S. government's own employees. I didn't receive a response. Later in the day, Blanca tells me more about what she's considering. She says she isn't sure she can wait out her court process in Mexico. And she's heard that if you lose your asylum case in the U.S., you go to prison. That isn't true. The other options are to try and cross the border undetected, which is not easy or certain, but some migrants here are considering it. Or Blanca may head back to Guatemala. She's not sure how she would get back now. She has no cash. She'll wait and see how things go in court this Thursday and then decide. For The World, Monica Campbell, Ciudad Juarez, Mexico.
Before we leave, here's a sneak preview of a story you'll hear tomorrow on the show. Gracias. It's about Venezuelan migrants who are showing up in neighboring Colombia, like this viola player who performs for spare change in Bogota. Other Venezuelans with fewer skills can only beg, and there are so many people on the streets that some Colombians are losing their patience and lashing out.
You know, these people who are begging on the streets, of which there are hundreds of Venezuelans doing this in Bogota now, do get, you know, the blunt end of the xenophobia.
Too many Venezuelans in Bogota. That story coming up tomorrow here on The World. Gracias. From all of us here in Boston in the Nan Bill Harris Studios, I'm Carol Hills. See you right here tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.